I'm Kevin Kunzman, Managing Editor of medical news site HCP Live. Welcome to Doc Talk. Welcome back to another 2022 recap episode of the flagship podcast series from hcplive.com. For more annual review pieces, catch up on our This Year in Medicine series as it runs through December, available at our homepage. And be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn for more news and insights in your favorite medicine specialties. In a field laden with biologic research breakthroughs and emerging practice-altering systemic therapy development, one of dermatology's most dominant headlines this last year was not regarding with what products we may use to treat eczema, but in how early may we begin to do so. Earlier this year, the FDA approved dupilumab for the treatment of atopic dermatitis in children as young as 6 months to 5 years old. The latest indication for the Sanofi Regeneron IL-4 and 13 inhibitor not only completes the drug's patient age spectrum of availability, it marks the first time that infants and toddlers could be eligible to treat early onset eczema with any biologic. Of course, novel indications require clear roadmaps to care, and there's many other evolving factors that play into treating pediatric eczema today. In this year-end episode of Doc Talk, we return to a prior conversation with researcher and dermatologist Lawrence Eichenfield, Chief of Pediatric and Adolescent Dermatology at the University of California, San Diego. Eichenfield spoke with HCP Live on a number of pediatric atopic dermatitis topics from 2022, including the dupilumab approval, the state of modern care strategies, best screening practices, biomarker research, and infant stage preventive practices. We hope you enjoy.
Dr. Eichenfield, thank you so much for joining on the eve of DermFall Clinical 2022. Really appreciate your time and excited to have this conversation with you on the topic of developments in pediatric dermatology, especially in the last year. There have been a lot of promising clinical developments, regulatory developments in that space that just really add to our capability in treating kids with skin disease. So wanted to kick it over to you and start off if you wanted to share what your key highlights are. What exactly would are you going to highlight and would you like to highlight as the key developments in 2022 for pediatric derm?
Well, the takeaway is there's a ton happening in the field and a lot in inflammatory skin diseases, and then a fair amount in genetic diseases or rarer skin diseases. Mm-hmm. So I'll start off the lead atopic dermatitis, right? We've had this tremendous change in our ability to manage atopic dermatitis with the development of new medications. You know, one of the lead points is that, you know, dupilumab, our first specifically approved biologic agent, you know, has gone down to 6 months of age in terms of its age indication. And it's been very eye-opening in the field. Tremendous impact on affected individuals and certainly a change in pediatric dermatology practice. There's other work being done in topical medications. So we're in the situation where there are several non-steroidal medications that are well along the way in clinical studies. Tapinarof, which has been approved for psoriasis in adults, being studied for atopic dermatitis. Roflumilast, approved for psoriasis ages 12 and older, also being studied for atopic dermatitis. In other systemic news, there was a great paper that was just presented at the EADV looking cyclosporin versus methotrexate in children. Mm-hmm. And while these are older medicines that may not do as much clearing as some of our newer ones, the design of the study and the methodology is really instructional to us. They thought that cyclosporin would be quicker at handling disease, but that methotrexate might catch up, and that methotrexate, if you're on it for a period of time and then stop it, would probably maintain the disease longer. And that's what the study showed. These were 2 to 16-year-olds with pretty significant eczema. And it showed that cyclosporin was quicker, but after multiple months of therapy and basically a prolonged follow-up time period, what they found is the number of people who flared and or needed other systemic medicine or made it back to as bad as they were when they started was quicker and more of them in cyclosporin than methotrexate. Mm-hmm. So, you know, on the other hand, you know, the objective eczema scores, the EASI scores were pretty much around 8, which is still sort of moderate level eczema. So it probably doesn't get kids as clear as the newer medicines, but it's really a core question with our newer systemic agents is what happens when you stop them? If you're on it for a period of time, do you get sustained remission or not?
Right.
Next. And, well, go ahead.
I was going to ask Dr. Eichenfeld on the basis of just this discussion about optimal care at the youngest ages possible for disease. And that raises a really excellent, interesting question of just what are the goalposts specifically for our youngest eligible dermatology patients that we're seeing with chronic skin disease? What exactly are we looking to do? Is it permanent clearance or is it something that's improved likelihood of management through life?
Yeah. So I think the younger the age of the patient, the more we're trying to figure out, do we really need it? But the need comes to, if you can't have someone with sustained, generally eczema-free, itch-free, still having, you know, not having sleep disturbance, that's the goal. Right. And if you can do that with a good topical regimen that's safe and not overwhelming, without using too much of the medication, that's fine. But if you can't, then the shift over into systemic medications, particularly right now, you know, biologic agents in particular, I think that's the next step, regardless of age. The unknown answers to the questions are, you know, for how long and will it change the overall course of the disease? But, you know, we'll look forward to collecting that data going forward.
For sure. Sure. In terms on the other side of the coin, obviously, so many of these new, better understood and available options for treating pediatric dermatologic conditions are not much of benefit unless we have, you know, primed screening and diagnostics available. Obviously, cases are increasing, correct, of chronic skin disease in children annually. Do you feel that, I guess, we have the best tools in place, the best guidelines, recommendations, and standards set to assure we're identifying the right patient at the right time?
Well, I'd say no and yes and no. The no is that, first of all, a lot of our pediatric colleagues, you know, they even heard about severity measures in atopic dermatitis, and they're not necessarily recognizing those patients early who I think could benefit from more aggressive intervention. Mm-hmm. That's my first no. The yes and no is that, you know, we have some decent outcome measures for how eczema impacts on the individuals and the, you know, quality of life influence. Translating that to clinical practice becomes trickier. Mm-hmm. But as I said, my sort of mantra of, you know, minimal rash, minimal itch, and minimal sleep disturbance is what I'm going for. Now, on the other hand, biomarker-wise, a very interesting paper that I'll discuss came out of Jacob Thiessen's group, which is looking at predictive biomarkers based on just tape stripping, where you take tape and you strip it off in babies, and it looks like they can predict the development of atopic dermatitis. So first of all, there's this thing called TARC, and TARC is thymus and activation regulated chemokine, and it's really interesting because it's known that TARC's a pretty good biomarker for eczema, for atopic dermatitis, and in fact, it's a member of the T helper cytokine family, so it tends to correlate with atopic dermatitis. Mm. It's been available commercially in Japan as like a standard blood test. You know, from back in like, you know, I think it was 2008, it got approved in Japan. And we know that Japanese literature. So it's something that goes up with atopic dermatitis. But basically, this Netherlands group did this really cool study where they were looking for barrier dysfunction in atopic newborns, where they called it the baby study. It was this prospective cohort where they did tape strips as well as look at transepidermal water loss and the development of eczema over time. And what they found is that that at birth, you couldn't find anything predictive of atopic dermatitis. TARC levels weren't elevated. There basically weren't changes yet enough to see. Mm-hmm. But at 2 months of age, in individuals who did not have atopic dermatitis of signs of eczema or history of eczema, that elevated TARC levels just from the tape stripping greatly predicted the development of atopic dermatitis. Atopic dermatitis in the first few months of life and or persistent atopic dermatitis as well. So this is sort of mind-bending. They also found one, there's a lipid marker as well. So there's this really intriguing concept of, can you predict early and maybe intervene early to change the course of the disease? And I'll pair that with another paper, which from Alan Irvine's group, that took a look at a different methodology of doing, of trying preventative moisturizers for eczema. And there have been two prior small studies that showed positive benefits to moisturizers. And then the follow-up big studies of those, the BEEP study and the Prevent AD All study, which ended up being negative. But and this was a study that was designed as a very aggressive intervention, or relatively aggressive, twice a day moisturizer from birth to 2 months, and only 2 months, in patients with high risk of development of eczema, also looking at those who had mutations, filigree mutations that would put them at a much, much higher rate of development of eczema. And the compliance adherence in the group was really high for doing applications. So it was like 78% plus reported, you know, at least daily use for all the time points. So in the intervention group was about 90% that they were using it, and about, and in the control group, they were allowed to use it if they wanted to use it or occasionally. It was, you know, very little use. The preventative aspect on eczema was incredibly powerful, markedly decreased development of eczema in the group who had had moisturizers, even more so in those who had a mutation that would put them at higher risk. It prevented it even more, so to speak, than in the control population. So whether this pans out again, I mean, it was sort of white Irish mothers who, you know, put their kids in the study. It was only one population, only one type of moisturizer cream, in this case, a ceramide-based moisturizer. So whether it's reproducible or not, you know, you don't know, but really fascinating, powerful study to think about.
And that was the question I was going to ask Dr. Eichenfeld. Are we talking about an over-the-counter option, or is this like a clinically supported?
Over-the-counter, you know, a pretty standard product that people have in the United States as well, with a sort of ceramide-containing cream. Yeah.
That's pretty fascinating. I mean, obviously, when we talk about the inherent risk of atopic disease from mother to child, and wanting to best assure opportunities for prevention, or identifying, as you're saying, our next iteration of patients, it's pretty clear right from there. And seeing a positive association with overall skincare right from the beginning as a benefit is pretty fascinating. Are there any other factors or elements that you think could contribute toward, I guess, positively preventing, or you would be able to?
Well, it's so interesting. I put the two studies together because, like in the first study, we talked about biomarkers and they're not there at birth, but by 2 months, you know, the kids don't have clinical lesions. There are these, there's activity that's happening in the epidermis that's setting them up for atopic dermatitis. So, you know, it raises the question, well, if you did moisturizer for 2 months, could you abrogate that and maybe get beyond the development risk? So we don't have the full answer yet, but it's a positive for someone wanting to try an intervention if you have a high risk family and they're asking about what they might do for their kids.
My wife has atopic disease on her side of the family. We have a newborn, so it's a very funny, personally implicating thing.
Okay, like, we understand that. Yeah.
We'll join the study right now. Yeah, she's been moisturizing and it seems to be helping. But nonetheless, very fascinating. I mean, the entire discussion around the atopic march and the inherent chain of these diseases is altogether fascinating. And it seems, Dr. Eichenfeld, and maybe I'm out of line for assuming this, but it seems as if like our dermatologic treatment availability is much more pronounced for pediatric patients than other iterations, say, you know, allergies and asthma and, you know, other things that younger children are at risk for. We seem more equipped or capable of being able to treat more severe forms.
It's relatively new that we've gotten this new set of agents. Yeah. And certainly, like, I run a multidisciplinary dermatology clinic along with an allergist. Mm-hmm. And just today we're interviewing. I just happened to finish the clinic this morning. And so fascinating. Instead of my multiple patients an hour, It's, you know, we have, you know, their hour and a half to 2 hour visits for the patients. They're seen by the allergist, seen by me, seen by a clinical pharmacist. But one of the things we've learned is the, you know, the holistic impact of the disease on the individual and a holistic approach to the individual really helps. Yeah. Yeah. It's not necessarily fixing the allergies fixes the eczema, yeah. but are they happy that we're addressing these other components of their disease? And certainly some of our medicines like dupilumab, you know, a pretty typical follow-up. I have a, you know, I asked how, you know, I said, he had asthma, right? To one of my patients, to, you know, follow-up patients, they're like, he had asthma. We haven't needed to touch an asthma med in a year.
Yeah.
On dupilumab, yeah. right? You have it's approved for asthma as well, but it was done for atopic derm. So it's interesting as we start to potentially influence these other aspects of the of the patients. Now another study, last study in systemics, so I'm going to quickly discuss baricitinib, not approved for atopic dermatitis in the United States, but they did their pediatric studies and had pretty good and some nice results there, but also some nice safety data. This was down to 2-year-olds. It was 2 to 17-year-olds with atopic derm. But I mentioned it because it's interesting as a transition, because one of the areas that has this tremendous change in practice is alopecia areata. And that same drug, while not approved for eczema, is approved for alopecia areata in adults. And it's sort of nice to have that pediatric data in any disease to go along as people start to, you know, further studies get done on baricitinib for alopecia areata as an oral JAK inhibitor. You know, some people advising off-label use, et cetera. But that's a disease that I'll also discuss briefly at the fall clinical, just for the incredible changes that are happening with both oral JAK inhibitors being utilized, but also oral minoxidil, which is something that was not on our list a year ago or 2 years ago. And now in many, many expert hands is being used liberally, very off-label for alopecia areata, for significant alopecia areata, without a good data set. But, you know, people are using it and thinking that it's very helpful.
Yeah. We had a conversation just earlier with Dr. Brett King, who will be attending Dermfall Clinical and talking about baricitinib and alopecia.
And, so Brett's wife is Brittany Craiglow, and she's also smack in the middle of that in both the JAK world and alopecia areata. And one of the people I think has been influential at believing that oral minoxidil is a nice adjuvant as well, which is changing PD derm practice.
It's just fascinating to hear the amount of patients who have come out of the woodwork to give another chance toward treating their condition with this availability now there. It really shows, I guess, the significance of that those products being regulated and evidenced and just progressed through. It's never done, so right?
I'll have one quick discussion on vitiligo as well. Because even though we don't have a lot of PEDS data there, we have some, right? We have the first approved drug for vitiligo in the United States, included patients 12 plus with topical ruxolitinib. And then in a sort of parallel process, but in the works, there's a, we're going to have our first pediatric guidelines for vitiligo management. So Nanette Silverberg is sort of the force behind that. And, you know, I do think I think that'll be useful for us because it's just a change, you know, there's a changing practice there. And just as we bring more evidence basis to it, I think it's going to be something that's really important.
Absolutely. And maybe on a final note, one, looking forward to those guidelines, and two, on a final note, Dr. Eichenfeld, any advice for prescribing clinicians who are encountering pediatric patients and parents who are, you know, over the moon excited over these availabilities, dupilumab, ruxolitinib, all these options that we're talking about, baricitinib. How, any broad advice for them navigating that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll do two things. So one's just the basic, but important is that get a sense to what the impact of the disease is on the individual and the family. Because if you get that out in the room, it helps with the decision-making process of if you're going to use a systemic agent, for instance. And the other is recognize that if you're uncertain about where we're at with systemic therapies in these evolving disease courses, then you're state-of-the-art. Because like for vitiligo and alopecia areata, these are rapidly changing worlds of care with approvals, non-approval studies, not studies in process, and which just every 4 months is different in terms of the data set we have. And so that's the way I sort of counsel my patients, is to say, you know, it's different with, with dupilumab in, pediatrics. We have data sets there that is more, you have a green light there. But with alopecia areata and vitiligo, where things would be off label, it's a very rapidly evolving field.
Absolutely. I think those are some really excellent sentiments, and something similar we heard from Dr. King is, considering the absolute benefit of the therapies and, navigating what exactly these outcomes could be. So thank you so much, Dr. Eichenfeld. I feel like we touched on a lot in just 20 minutes. Is there anything else you want to add, though, relevant to our discussion?
No, thanks for the opportunity. I think it's hard not to be excited now in pediatric dermatology because there are such changes. Yeah. And these changes are really, they're changes that are life-altering for the patients and the families.
Absolutely. Yeah, just try to not be excited about everything going on here. So you really covered it comprehensively. I can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing your expertise. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Take care.
Thanks again to Dr. Eichenfeld for his insights earlier this year, and all the dermatology experts and investigators who helped us navigate an exceptionally busy 2022. For more end-of-year reflections and this year in medicine entries, be sure to check us out at hcplive.com and find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. From HCP Live's Doc Talk, I'm Kevin Kunzman. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays.